Hey everybody, welcome back to the Curiosity Chronicles. Gonna have to jump into this pretty quick. We are talking about Charles Manson, the Manson family, and Helter Skelter. This was a massive, massive podcast that I'm going to be breaking into two episodes. However, it's basically one large episode. I'm gonna split the recording. I'm gonna record them simultaneously. I'm going to release them simultaneously, but it'll be a little bit easier to listen to. This was by far the most research-intensive episode I have ever done. I hope I have done it justice. I hope it's very interesting for you, but I do want to mention something before we get going. This episode is marked as explicit. It's the first time I've ever done that. I did my best to keep this as tame as possible. I try not to be gratuitously over the top. However, there were certain aspects of this podcast that I could not skip over and maintain the historical accuracy and integrity. Therefore, big disclaimer before we get into this episode or two episodes. If you are squeamish or if you are at all uncomfortable with topics of violence and sex, then I'm going to need you to not listen to this podcast. Again, it's not gratuitous, but it was necessary to include in this podcast. So, listener discretion is strongly advised for these two episodes on Helter Skelter. Now, with that being said, let's jump into this. Charles Manson, Helter Skelter, the murders that shook the world in 1969. This story gets insane. But for reasons that I can't quite wrap my head around, darkly fascinating. Man, was it fascinating. A little sickening, but fascinating. I'm not going to lie. I'm not necessarily proud of the fact how fascinated I was of this, but I am. So let's jump into it. I am Brett Bielsma. I am the host of the Curiosity Chronicles, and this is what I was curious about this month. So in order to understand what happens later on in Charles Manson's life, we have to go way back to the beginning. November 12, 1934, Charles Manson is born to a woman named Kathleen Maddox. Kathleen Maddox was not a woman that anybody would wish to be their mother or anybody that should have had children in the first place. She was 16, she was a prostitute, allegedly, and she was an alcoholic. On top of that, Manson never met or knew who his biological father was. Kathleen did. At one point, she filed a paternity suit, I believe, but Manson never knew or really cared who his father was. Later on, Kathleen Maddox married William Manson. It ended very quickly. Manson divorced her due to her neglect of Charles Manson, as well as her heavy drinking. Obviously, Charles kept the Manson name and was known for the rest of his life as Charles Manson. Kathleen was arrested for armed robbery. Charles went to live with an uncle and aunt. And then after she got out of prison, I think it was, it escapes me how long it was, but maybe 5 or 6 years, she came and reclaimed her son. She was extraordinarily neglectful. At this point, Manson was about 12. She enrolled him in the Gibault School for Boys. She was unloading him. She did not want to care for him. Dropped him off at this boarding school. Manson did not adjust to school well. According to school records, he was moody with a persecution complex. Everybody was out to get Charles. So he ran away, but he ran to his mother who didn't want him. So he ran away again. He started burglaring stores and was quickly caught. He was young and did not get away with it and was sent to Father Flanagan's Boys Town, which is an odd name. And I don't even recall exactly what that is, but I believe it was some sort of priest-run reformatory slash boarding school. He was 13. He, again, was not adjusting to Father Flanagan's well. He and another boy stole a car, ran away, started committing armed robberies. And because they were armed robberies, although I don't recall exactly what weapon he was using at the time, I did not want to spend a ton of time on his childhood. That's why the details are a little bit sketchy, but I wanted to give you a quick overview of his life to inform later decisions that he made. Anyway, he committed at 13 his first violent crime in terms of legality. Legally, armed robbery is considered a violent crime even if nobody was injured. He was sent to the Indiana School for Boys at Plainfield. He was there for 3 years, ran away 18 times. Again, not a well-adjusted young person. No excuses for what happens in his life when he was a child and later in his adult life, but man, he had a rough childhood. His mother was awful, and he just bounced around from school to school to reformatory to this to that to the next thing. 1951, February of 1951, he and some other boys from this Indiana School for Boys stole a car, again, headed for California. On the way to California, the boys robbed gas stations and stores. And in later interviews, Manson said that he estimates that he probably knocked over about 15 to 20 gas stations. This spree of crime out to California was also the first time in his life that Charles Manson broke federal law. He took a stolen car over state lines. That is a federal crime. He was caught, remanded to the National Training School for Boys in Washington, D.C., started getting some tests done in terms of his psychiatry, his psychology, as well as his intellect. He was given an IQ test, came back at 109, which is the upper end of average, nothing special, but not stupid. But he was illiterate. He had not had any real formal education in his life, and so into his teen years, he was still considered illiterate. A caseworker concluded he was also aggressively antisocial. It was also in 1951 at this DC boys' school that a psychiatrist named Dr. Block examined him. And he concluded that, and these were his words from his report, because of his small stature, he was very short and think he maxed out at like 5'4" in his adult life. Because of his small stature, his bastard birth, and his lack of parental love, quote, he is constantly striving for status with the other boys. And then continuing the quote from the report, he developed certain facile techniques for dealing with people. These, for the most part, consist of a good sense of humor and an ability to ingratiate himself. So already at a young age, in his teen years, Manson was learning how to be manipulative and get what he wanted from people, even though he was also aggressively antisocial. So he was transferred to Natural Bridge Camp, another reformatory, and for a while he was pretty much your model citizen, so to speak, for that location. And he was in line for parole, but then kind of out of the blue, he was caught sexually assaulting another boy at knife point. So obviously was not given his parole and was transferred again to a federal reformatory where he was considered dangerous and untrustworthy. He committed 8 serious offenses at this federal reformatory, and a report claimed that he was homosexual with assaultive tendencies. So for his safety as well as for the others around him, he was transferred to a different federal reformatory in Ohio. And suddenly, he changed his behavior, became basically a model, not prisoner, but model inmate at this reformatory, I guess you'd call it. And on May 8, 1954, he was paroled at 19 years old. At this point, he met and married a woman named Rosalie Jean Willis. She got pregnant, and Manson went right back to his criminal ways. He stole cars at least twice, again breaking federal law by driving them across state lines and heading for California, where he again was arrested. A psychiatrist admitted that his unstable personality, admitted that he had an unstable personality, but said institutions did Charles Manson no good. He obviously was not being reformed in these institutions, continued to go back to crime and crime and criminal activity. So the psychiatrist said maybe marriage and soon-to-be fatherhood would straighten him out. And so he was given 5 years probation for this stealing of cars and breaking federal law. Of course, he skipped out on his hearing for a different crime of stealing a car in Florida. And so a warrant was issued, probation was revoked, and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. And over the next multiple years, he was in and out of prison for all kinds of different offenses. He was arrested and in prison for robbery, battery. He was a pimp for a good portion of time, learned how to manipulate women by being a pimp. That's extremely important later on. And by age 32 in 1967, he had spent 17 years of his life in different institutions or prison. He actually, at one point, begged the authorities to let him stay in prison for the rest of his life. He wanted to remain in prison in the institutions. That's where he was most comfortable. And he was not comfortable being in the outside world, which makes sense because he'd spent more than half his life in an institution. He was denied, released on March 21, 1967. And at that point, he started looking for meaning in his life. And now we get to the founding of the Manson family. So this is when things start to get really strange. Manson, after his release from prison, made his way to San Francisco. That's where he met a woman named Mary Brunner, and he moved in with her. And she has the dubious distinction of becoming the first member of the Manson family. Despite Mary's protestations, Manson continued to meet and invite women to move in with him. At some point, there was possibly up to 18 women living in Mary Brunner's house at the invite of Charles Manson. This was also the point where Manson discovers the Haight-Ashbury district. Haight-Ashbury is a epicenter of the hippie counterculture movement, especially in 1967. It's located in San Francisco, and throughout a lot of the 1960s, like I said, it was a gathering place for the hippies and the counterculture. But in 1967, especially, thousands of young Americans had come to Haight-Ashbury for the Summer of Love. They were there to protest the Vietnam War, but also to expand their minds. They were expanding their minds through alternative religion, rock music, and drugs, particularly LSD and other psychoactive drugs. This was a perfect breeding ground for the Manson family. According to a journalist, Jeff Ginn, I don't know how to pronounce his name, G-U-I-N-N, he wrote a book about Charles Manson, and he said Manson was, quote, the wrong man in the right place at the right time. Haight-Ashbury is exactly what you think of when you think of the hippie counterculture movement and that stereotypical peace, love, and happiness kind of 1960s vibe. But there was also quite a few vulnerable people there, and especially vulnerable women looking for direction in their life. And unfortunately, Charles Manson was able to give them that direction. It was not good direction by any means, as you'll see, but it was a direction. Manson was a con man. He was using skills that he learned from pimping, but while he was in prison, he also did a lot of studying of Scientology, and he read up on Dale Carnegie and, you know, how to win friends and influence people, things of that nature. And he could spin a serious line of BS, and it attracted young, impressionable hippies. He was a little bit older, keep in mind. Was he 32 at this age? At this point, I think he was. And most of the people that he attracted were in their late teens and early 20s. They looked up to him, especially because he was able to spin this BS. He attracted mostly young women. Eventually, he started to attract some younger men. And again, like I said, he knew how to manipulate people. Prison taught the Dale Carnegie classes. Later testimony from multiple people would say that it was like Charles Manson could read their mind. He was like the friend that they never had, but became their best friend. And most of the crap that he spewed came almost directly quoted from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. These people were young, they were naive, they were impressionable, and they easily fell under Charles Manson's spell. And he used all of this confluence of circumstance, to found his family. And I keep saying that, what is the family? It was a cult. It was a large cult founded by Charles Manson, and it was mostly women, up to possibly about 100 members at its largest. Mostly women, some men, but there were certain people. I obviously can't talk about all 100 of them, but there are certain ones that I do need to mention for the purposes of this podcast. So the core important group for the purposes of this podcast, there's a woman named Susan Atkins. She was a vulnerable woman due to a childhood of alcoholic parents and abandonment. And she joined Manson in 1967 when she was about 18 or 19 years old. She believed that Manson was Jesus Christ reborn. And she was a fanatical follower. You'll catch a theme going forward here. Leslie Van Houten, she began using drugs at 15, ran away from home, returned home briefly to finish high school, but then ran away again, joined up with Manson. She was a heavy user of LSD and other psychedelics. There was also Patricia Krenwinkel. She was insecure, overweight, and bullied as a child. She joined up with Manson in her early 20s. Important male figure in the Manson family was Charles, nicknamed Tex Watson. He was from Texas. He was an honor student and athlete, a little bit different. His upbringing was not nearly as fractured. But he flew to LA and became immersed in the drug and music scene, was attracted to Manson, introduced to Manson, and joined his family, became a key figure in the Manson family, Manson's right-hand fist, so to speak. There was also a man named Bobby Beausoleil, sent to a reform camp for delinquent behavior at 15, ran away, made it to LA and San Francisco, and joined the family. And two more, Linda Kasabian. She met Manson through a different family member when she was 19. She eventually became disillusioned and distrustful of Charles Manson and the Manson family, but she stuck around. She becomes very important. Her disillusionment with the family is an extremely important aspect of her life when we get to later events. Remember Linda Kasabian. And Lynette Fromm, she was nicknamed Squeaky. She was one of Manson's most trusted family members, fanatically devoted to Manson, although was not part of the upcoming murders, but she does come back into history later on, and I'll get to that at the end of the podcast. Those are some of the major players in this story. But the cult itself was much larger. And I'm not kidding, guys. If you want to read up on this, please do. If you're interested in this, I probably only touch on about 20% of some of the information out there. Maybe 20 to 30%. I mean, there is so much information that I don't even touch on because I just did not have time. I could have probably done 5 or 6 episodes on this. A lot of my research came from the prosecutor of Manson, a guy named Vincent Bugliosi. He is a very good author as well as a prosecutor. And he wrote a book called Helter Skelter that I read a while back and then reread for this podcast. It is the best-selling true crime book of all time. It's fantastic, but it is just jam-packed with information. I skipped a ton of it. So if you're interested, the citation is in the notes for this podcast episode. Anyway, as I was reading the research, the question that kept coming back was, how? How did this happen? How was Manson able to have this fanatical following of men and women that were willing to do anything for him? It didn't make sense to me. I'm not exactly someone who is easily convinced of anything. I like to do the research and things like that. But that, how can someone so completely be overcome with another person? It boggled my mind. I did a little bit of research into that. I didn't really find any definitive answers like this is how he did it, psychologically speaking. But I did find enough information to satisfy, you know, my curiosity. So how did he manipulate these people. Again, he was a master manipulator, and he was able to exploit the counterculture. He styled himself as like a street preacher or a guru. That's a hard word to say, apparently. And that was a common thing in Haight-Ashbury, gurus, street preachers. He was just one of many. Tex Watson said in an interview later on in his life, he also wrote an autobiography that had some information in it about Manson in the early years of the Manson family. He said the Manson followers were young and angry. Quote, I was looking for love, identity, direction, and acceptance. I had no sound belief system. Manson suddenly appears on the scene, and he seems to provide all of those things. Love, direction, acceptance, that's a big one. But also, he gives them something to believe in. It was horrendously misguided and not a belief system that anybody should have, but they gobbled it up. Manson knew from his years as a pimp who was most easily manipulated. He targeted and preyed on girls from strict or broken homes. But it wasn't just that he was able to grab them up from a strict or broken home after they ran away and automatically they were his. He needed a way to basically break them down so that he can control them. He did that using sex. He was able to use sex to get rid of their inhibitions. According to a man, Dr. David Smith, Manson would use sex to wear away, quote, the middle-class morality of the girls. Once that morality was worn down, he could control them and they would do things for him that normal people would not. He wears away their morality and he replaces it with what he believes. So all of these girls were used in I'm not even going to go into it. It's disgusting. It really is. But they were willing to do these things because they're angry at their parents, because they were high on drugs. And as they continued down this pathway into basically moral abandonment, the more that Manson asked them to do, the less inhibitions they had, and they did it. And the more that they were willing to do what Manson said, the more he became the authoritative figure in their life. And then, of course, besides sex, drugs, especially psychedelics like LSD, were liberally employed to control the family. Manson would get the family in a big group. They would all take LSD. They would be tripping. And Manson would preach and basically brainwash them. They were more receptive to his incredibly wacky ideas because they were tripping on LSD. It's insanity. Unfortunately, not something, this isn't the only cult that was to arise from these types of damaged individuals. It's just that they are definitely the most famous ones. Manson's goal at first was to follow the counterculture tropes. There's a quote from one of the Manson families. Said it was free them from their past, all sexual inhibitions, all ego and fear, and turn them into his image of love, end quote. So he would spout these counterculture philosophies, and then he would use his manipulative skills to actually isolate the cult, his family, from the actual counterculture. So using counterculture tropes while also isolating his family so that the only people they interacted with for the most part on a daily basis, was other family members. He didn't want any outside ideas getting through his brainwashing. He was always in soul control. Manson was in soul control of the family. Again, a quote from Tex Watson. Quote, he was always changing his movements, his appearance, his dress. Rockstar, guru, devil, son of God, even a child. He was a magician and a charmer. He was aware, almost cat-like. His eyes had the ability to psych you out immediately. And that's something that non-family members will say. Courtroom reports later on say that Manson had a stare. that would just captivate you. And it was freaky. So that is, as best as I could find, that was the how of how Manson founded and controlled his family. It's creepy, it's disgusting, but that's what happened. So early on in the founding of the family, Manson's goals were very strange, very weird, but at the time not violent. He obviously wanted to be in control. He was a cult leader who's charismatic and extraordinarily unhealthy for the family to submit to him, but it wasn't violent yet. His ultimate goal, Charles Manson's ultimate goal, was to become a music superstar. And you laugh, kind of, knowing what's coming, but that was his true goal. And he was a moderately talented musician. And through coincidence, he actually got a shot at becoming a musical superstar. In the spring of 1968, Dennis Wilson, who happened to be the drummer of the Beach Boys, picked up two hitchhikers that were part of the Manson family. Crazy, like, just a weird coincidence. Wilson took them home, and then he went to a recording session. When Wilson got home, Manson and about a dozen of the family were in Wilson's home. And they stayed. They lived with the drummer of the Beach Boys for a few months, believe it or not. And at first, Wilson was somewhat captivated with Manson. There is no denying that Manson was charismatic and people kind of gravitated towards him. And Wilson didn't necessarily find him that talented, but he actually did try to help him get a record deal. But Wilson got pretty annoyed with them eventually because they were total freeloaders. They ate his food. They took and used and sometimes crashed his cars. They wore his clothes, took his wardrobe. Wilson estimates the family cost him upwards of $100,000 in a couple months. Which is just insane. It wasn't like the whole family was living there either. It was a large group, but not the whole 100. Dennis Wilson did introduce Manson to other influential people in the music industry. People like Terry Melcher. He was a record producer, I believe. He was the son of Doris Day. And Manson tried to recruit Dean Martin's daughter to the family. She did not. She rejected him. And he also tried to recruit the rest of the Beach Boys to the family. They all rejected him. Keeping in mind, at this point, the Beach Boys were they're the most successful American rock band of all time. And 1968 was the height of their popularity. Manson was making important friends if he wanted to be a musical superstar. Unfortunately, he didn't impress them with his talent. Although I do think there are some B-side recordings that the Beach Boys may have used that had some sort of influence from Manson. Like, his recordings are out there. You can listen to them. But in the end, you know, long story short here, he met with a lot of people. He was considered a talented amateur, but was not signed to any deal. And this may have been the breaking point for Manson. Because obviously, from his childhood and then going out to Haight-Ashbury and founding the family, he's definitely got a few screws loose. But maybe, and I'm not saying for sure by any means, but let's say he does get a record deal, maybe the tragedies that come later don't happen. I'm not saying that he's going to live a normal life by any means. I don't see anything ending happily for Charles Manson. But maybe if he gets his record deal, he becomes a musical star and he's only super weird, but not super weird and criminal. But that's not what happened. He was not signed. Manson regarded it as a betrayal by, quote, the establishment, which you hear all the time from different criminals, and it played into his motives for what came next. And what came next was Helter Skelter. And strap in, because this is where things go from pretty weird to completely over-the-top insanity. All right, hold on to your butts, because here we go. November of 1968, the Beatles, also a huge influence on Charles Manson, he loved the Beatles, released the White Album. The White Album is a very famous album by the Beatles. It has songs such as Blackbird, Dear Prudence, Piggies, and most importantly, a song called Helter Skelter. Wow, I messed up the most important song. Helter Skelter. It's a hugely influential album, and just in terms of music, it's considered one of the best albums of all time. Manson was obsessed with the Beatles, and especially when the White Album. This is the point where Manson, like, something happens, and all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, this guy, who was already crazy to begin with, is, I'm not kidding, literally one of the craziest people I think history has ever produced. And I mean that not facetiously or as, like, a hyperbole. I legitimately think Charles Manson might have been one of the craziest people to ever have lived. So Manson believed that the White Album from the Beatles had hidden messages built into it that were for him specifically, because, of course, according to him, he was the chosen one. And Manson used the White Album, as well as biblical teachings and language, developed the theory of Helter Skelter. So Helter Skelter, I'm going to try to just give you the facts here without, what I always do whenever I talk about this with people is, like, I have to, like, take a second and be like, holy crap, is this real? This is real. Okay, first off, before we get anywhere, Helter Skelter is a British term for a playground slide. So that's important because it's definitely not what Charles Manson thinks it is. Paul McCartney of the Beatles wrote the song Helter Skelter, and it was about, according to him, the downfall of the Roman Empire, which is a whole nother thing to unpack. Like, that is, where did that come from? But, you know, it's the Beatles, so whatever. Manson believed, on the other hand, that Helter Skelter, the song, and the White Album as a whole was talking about an apocalyptic race war. And to him, it referred to a very twisted interpretation of Revelation, the book in the Bible. And so he developed this theory. And he proclaimed to his family that there was a Armageddon, an upcoming apocalyptic race war. And to set it off, it would have to start with the murder of some influential white people. So after these influential white people were murdered, the white people would get paranoid and they would blame the murders on African Americans, the blacks, as Manson would call them. And so the paranoid white people, to protect themselves, would start killing black people and going into their neighborhoods and killing them until it turned into a full-blown race war. Now, during the beginning of the race war, the black Muslims and the Black Panthers would be in hiding. And then this is just so out of control. So the Black Panthers, Black Muslims would be in hiding, and then the white race would have a split between the hippie liberals and the uptight conservatives, and the white people would start killing each other. So it's a race war, but then it turns into like a white civil war. I'm not making this up. This is literally what he thought. Now, once nearly all the white people were dead, the Black Panthers and the Black Muslims would come out of hiding and kill the remaining white people, ending the race war. Okay, I'm not laughing because this is funny. I'm laughing because this is so batshit. Anyway, during the race war, Manson and his family would also be hiding and safe in what he called the bottomless pit. Which, if you've read Revelation, you understand where he's getting this idea. According to Manson, there was a hole in Death Valley, which led deep into the center of the earth, where there was a whole civilization. And in this center of the earth civilization, it was the land of milk and honey. The walls glowed. There's magical fruit trees. There was the tree of life, which apparently, according to him, had 12 different fruits, and each month a different fruit would come from this tree, and they would all eat this tree. It was very Garden of Eden-like, all this biblical language. And the idea from the bottomless pit actually came directly from Revelation 9. Quote, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit." The family firmly believed that Charles Manson was the fifth angel from Revelation 9 and the king of the bottomless pit, which, I just, first off, horrendous interpretation of the Bible, but let's not go there. So after the race war was done, the Manson family, which now numbers 144,000, also from Revelation, all white, they're all white in the Manson family, because believe it or not, shockingly, Manson was incredibly racist. They would come out of the bottomless pit after the race war was done. And according to Manson, what would happen is the black people had won the race war, but now, because they are black, they are not able to run the world. They're not capable, according to him, of doing anything but pick cotton. Horrible person at this point, regardless of everything else he's done, just to be able to say that. It's like, that is a bad man. So the black people would come to Manson and his family as the only white people left and kindly ask him to take over. And the black race would become the Manson family's servants. And Charles Manson, who the family believed was Jesus Christ and the fifth angel, would rule the world. And that is what Helter Skelter was. Holy cow. I don't know what screw popped loose in Charles Manson's head or when exactly it popped loose, but that thing popped loose and just blew a hole through any logical part of his brain. Whew. But the craziest thing is the whole family believed this. They went along with it. They're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And they were actively searching Death Valley for the hole to the bottomless pit. And then when Charles Manson gave them orders to start this Helter Skelter race war, they were like, yeah, sure thing. Let's go do this. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. But it's true. Now, Charles Manson denied Helter Skelter, as of course he would when he was trying to save his own butt from getting the death penalty later on. He said Helter Skelter was made up by the prosecutor to tie him to the murders that he had no part in. But I'm telling you, from the research and from the testimonies that people gave, this is all 100% true. I rarely will say that, but I have zero ambiguity on this. Charles Manson believed this because he was crazy. But race war couldn't start without some white people getting murdered. Charles Manson took it upon himself and the family to get this whole Helter Skelter thing going. That's what we're going to talk about in part two. So stick around. Go over to part two, listen, and hear the rest of the story.